Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Charles Williamson. I represent the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. We sympathize with the and certainly endorse the efforts of the nonprofit corporations serving this population. And as much as these efforts may need money, we suggest the money be provided not by the most seriously injured people that they happen to hurt through negligence, but through taxes or whatever other sources of funds may be available, their contracts with the state. People should pay the actual cost of what they're getting, and not when you're turning around looking for someone to tax, taxing somebody you don't know who it is yet, but down the road somebody's going to be a quadriplegic, a paraplegic, very seriously injured, more than $100,000. What you're proposing to do is to take that person's money now to benefit these programs, and that is, we submit, not the proper way to fund these programs. They should have money. They should be able to get what they need to serve these people, but it shouldn't be with injured people's just recoveries. The case that's been made for this proposal, I have not heard how much would be saved. I haven't even heard that they can't afford the present insurance. I haven't heard there's a program that's been in existence for 24 years and hasn't been sued for more than they can afford yet. I can't understand the justification for taking away the most seriously injured people's recoveries at this time. Supreme Court wrote with regard to a medical malpractice statute that it is simply unfair and unreasonable to impose the burden of supporting a medical care industry solely upon those persons who are the most severely injured and therefore most in need of compensation. When you look at whether the state, well, I guess I would point out that the state of Oregon's constitutional right to impose a tort claims limit on itself has been subject to question. While it's been recently upheld, it has never been held that the state can even extend those tort claim limits to its own employees. That was not extended until 1975. At common law, you could sue a public employee for whatever, for the damage they did to you. So the court in considering that issue said, in considering whether the Tort Claims Act was constitutional, said we expressed no opinion as to whether whether the limitation of liability of public employees, agents, and officers is proper under the Oregon Constitution. That was in a footnote. And certainly if there's some question as to whether or not the state can extend its tort claim limits, its sovereign immunity limits to its own employees, to extend it to private corporations, I think is clearly an extra step.
Mr. Williamson, what would happen if would the constitutional argument be the same if instead of saying we're extending sovereign immunity and state tort claims limits protection to private nonprofits, would we avoid the problem you're discussing if we simply said tort liability for private nonprofits shall be limited to X dollars?
You can do that. You can say you're just establishing. What you, in essence, are doing is saying you're establishing a cap because you're not doing. You're really not extending sovereign immunity.
So we never mention state tort claims at all. We just say we're going to put a cap on liability for nonprofits of X dollars.
Well, before I say whether
you don't feel any better about that.
No, I think it's clearly unconstitutional as well on different grounds. But the legislature in 1975 passed a scheme to deal with medical malpractice cases where they set up a fund for excess liability, a state fund, and put caps on. And the physicians in the state didn't, and the insurers, I assume as well, but the physicians didn't want to go along with it because they didn't know if it was constitutional. They didn't think it was. They wanted to get the Supreme Court to decide. The Supreme Court said we can't decide until somebody's been injured and we can see all the facts of their case. We won't decide. That law stayed on the books for 12 years. It was repealed in 1987. Never went into effect. If you pass this law, any government agency, I mean, I'm fairly confident that the state of Oregon now carries liability insurance in excess of the tort claims limits because they are afraid it will not apply, won't apply to their employees, or it may not apply to them. It may be ruled unconstitutional. I don't think that this is going to. I would not feel safe if I were on the board of this company and they said we're just going to carry $200,000 or $100,000. because this law is passed, they're going to be carrying the same limits they do now. It's not going to save anybody. I guess what I'm trying to say, it's not going to save anybody any money. Just down the road, if it is ruled unconstitutional, some very seriously injured person is going to be grossly treated unfairly by this law.
I'm familiar because we've heard from the OTLA before why you're uncomfortable with the constitutionality of the Tort Claims Act. Can you briefly, and maybe it's in your testimony, can you briefly outline why the other approach, a straight cap, is unconstitutional?
Well, we have a cap now, a $500,000 cap on non-economic damages. This cap is far more harsh than that. This won't even pay your medical bills and your out-of-pocket costs. This is an extremely vicious cap. I might point out that neither California or Washington even has a tort claims cap.
And the Washington, under Sophie versus Fiber Board, threw that out on the basis of the Washington Constitution guarantee of trial by jury.
That's right. That wasn't the Oregon cap. They had a separate cap on non-economic damages only.
Right.
And they said that violated the trial by jury. I've cited a Willamette University Law Review article that analyzed that and said they didn't think that cap, just the $500,000 cap, would withstand Oregon constitutional scrutiny on either equal protection or trial by jury grounds. Now,
if you can, make one request, Mr. Chair. I don't know what the chair's intention is on this bill, Mr. Williamson, as far as today, but if you can get me a copy of that Willamette Law Review article, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, I will do so.
Who wrote it?
Miller.
Sorry, just on that same.
I think a fellow named Peter Tiller, I believe his name was.
Anybody named Williamson?
No. I believe the fellow is clerking in the Legislative Council's office, as a matter of fact. It has nothing to do with OTLA.
Let's go talk to him.
I guess the other point I would make is just on the workability of this statute. What if you've got somebody who's driving down the street and this covers automobiles. This covers anybody. They're driving down the street in a van. They're delivering two patients. One of them's under a state contract. One of them isn't. They run over somebody and render them a quadriplegic. Does this bill apply or doesn't it? It's a basically unworkable bill. It won't work because it's so constitutionally infirm, nobody's going to lower their insurance rates based upon it. It's just if it's ever ruled constitutional, it'll very badly hurt someone then, and it won't apply because it won't work because it's basically simply unworkable. If there is a problem with insurance rates for these programs, we would very much appreciate the opportunity of working with the DIF, with the programs, to get insurance that's affordable for them. We would do that. We don't have any figures or information right now on what the problem is, but we would be glad to do that if the committee would like us to pursue that course. Thank you very much for your attention. I'm glad to answer any questions if anybody has any.
Representative Bell.
I guess I do have a question. In listening to your discussion, is it the whole system that allows public entities to have limits on their liability that bothers you, or is there something special about these particular groups that is above and beyond this law that we already have that allows, or is it just the whole concept of allowing another group? Is there anything specific about?
Well, Representative Bell, we believe that people should be responsible for their actions.
So
if you hurt somebody for more than the tort claim limits, we hate the tort claim limits, that's what you're saying. We hate it
right,
as applied
to
local government. And the Supreme Court wrote, and again, this was before the Tort Claims Act, but the Supreme Court said the doctrine of sovereign immunity is not defensible. It is the most universally criticized. The doctrine should therefore be held within the narrowest limits to which the language of Article 4, Section 24 is susceptible. It's something that should not be expanded.
Yeah, I understand your argument there completely. I just wondered if there's anything more that you would hate about it by including these people who deal with state, patients and clients. Is there anything more that you hate about it just including them, or is it just the whole shebang? I gather it's the whole thing that you really oppose.
I suppose every tort limit, he's never seen a tort limit he did like.
I can't, you know, it's, I can't think of anything special about these. These are very fine programs, and we think they should absolutely be.
I mean, your argument isn't that this isn't state, and there isn't any state involvement, so they shouldn't be involved, and that's...
Well, it isn't a state involvement. They are not state programs. They are private. Oh, I guess I could say I can organize my law office as a nonprofit corporation.
Well,
it just depends on whether you have a surplus at the end. Anybody can start a nonprofit corporation.
But
you just have to pay out all your profits and salaries and have the corporation make no profit. So anybody can have a corporation that's nonprofit that feeds its principles very, very well. And you could have a hospital or a clinic start one of these programs that's truly paying very, very good salaries to the people involved, but still get the shield that you would pass.
But
thank you, Charlie. We're
Mr.
a dissertation
Chair?
On nonprofit
corporation. No. But the
Representative Maddox.
I'll probably say the same thing Representative Clark was going to say. Now, wait a minute, Charlie. I mean, you're going way beyond what this bill does. This bill looks to entities that are out there doing what the state ought to be doing directly, but is so darned bureaucratic that it can't get its act together, so it contracts out to nonprofits to do it. And it hands them the money and says, act for us as our instrumentality. The one way, although we may try some other approaches here, the one way I can conceptualize this is, well, we are basically understanding and recognizing that some of these nonprofits are acting like instrumentalities of the state to do that which we did before, take 50 people out of Fairview and put them in 10 different group homes and pay those 10 group homes to do what we were trying to do inefficiently, perhaps, but with good faith, in Fairview. And so I don't think it's fair to start saying that we're talking about just letting anybody throw together a nonprofit and suck up to the government's tort immunity. This is a much narrower concept. Good or bad, it's a much narrower concept, and I don't think we should go down the wrong path here. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you.
May I respond?
Oh, yes.
Oh, you bet.
I think
you want to do it
fair.
Once, or do you want to do it once after he finishes with you, too?
I'll forget.
Okay, go ahead.
I guess I think if these are things that the state should be doing, Representative Mannix, they should pay the programs enough to buy themselves liability insurance to protect themselves. And secondly, I understand the concept of the impetus behind the bill, but you have to look at how the bill is drafted and what can be done under the bill, not just the idea of the people that drafted it.
Thank you.
Representative Clark.
Well, no, that's okay.
All right. Well, see, Charlie, killed two birds with one stone. Any further questions from Mr.
Williamson?
Do those birds have a right of action?
I don't know if they do. We have to check on that. Probably have to wear seatbelts if they sat in the front of the car, though. Miss Millis. Have I slaughtered that last name, Sandra?
Millius
and Associates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Sandra Millius, and I represent Oregon Community Mental Health Providers Association, Alcohol and Drug Program Directors Association, residential providers, all of whom are folks who would be subject to this bill. I actually didn't plan to testify today. Having been away from the Capitol for a few days, I was a little surprised that this bill was up today, but that's my problem. But I did want to offer some support and for the bill and suggest to you that we would be most happy, the organizations that I represent, to bring more data for the committee with respect to current insurance rates and so on. In times past, I worked for the City of Portland, who is covered by this very statute that you are looking at. That did never deter anyone from suing the city over, I assure you, virtually anything. What it does is place a limit on the amount of recovery in any of those actions. And essentially, all this does is extend to another group of state contractors, that is, folks who contract either with the state directly or who contract through the county with programs, folks who are extremely well regulated by administrative rule, folks who are generally required, for the most part, to hire folks who are certified by professional organizations, from psychiatrists through social workers to counselors, et cetera, to work in the kinds of facilities that we are talking about. So they are essentially small to medium-sized businesses in each one of your communities. A program that covers a number of the kinds of programs that we might be talking about here, for instance, is Laurel Hill Center in Eugene, which provides the kinds of rehabilitation services that Representative Walden and his witness were speaking about. They also provide outpatient-type services for folks who have been diagnosed as having a mental illness, who are entrusted to their care. And they provide a variety of those kinds of services. That's one of the kinds of organizations that we would be talking about. Another might be, for instance, Tualatin Valley Community Mental Health in Washington County, who provides essentially, again, a broad variety of community services, that is, services directed to people who are in the community for those folks. And I certainly am not a lawyer, cannot comment on the constitutionality, but
excuse me, I want to ask about the forensics point. Somebody who's being discharged from the state hospital, who has perhaps, you know, maybe got there through a criminal proceeding, and do these sorts of nonprofit corporation facilities handle those as a sort of a halfway house type?
I think anyone who has been criminally charged who's in the state hospital, I think there are only a few folks who are now, quote, in the community, in community service. And those folks are in a special program that operates under very special, secure guidelines, I think, in your community.
I think
those
are
the only folks who are, as a matter of fact, in that situation in the state. For the most part,
well, would those those institutions or those facilities fall under this definition?
As I see this written, I expect that those folks would fall under that definition.
Okay. Now, second question: do these types of facilities? One of the witnesses said that virtually all of her clients, patients, however, whatever the word term is used, were under contract from the state. They came to them by the state. Is that the rule, or are there mixes where some of the patients are private and others are there under contract from the state?
In the organizations that I represent, the general rule is that very few more than 10% of their client mix at any time is non-state funded. Now, I do have, for instance, let me give you an example. In Southeast Portland, the Community Mental Health Center there, Southeast Mental Health Network, has a program that operates quite separately that is a public program from a program that is insurance-based. They are totally operationally, they are separate operationally. So I don't think you would necessarily be mixing things in that case. That is, on the one hand, they're doing some EAP work, and on the other hand, they are dealing with folks who've been contracted through the state.
What, in a rough sense, what percentage of these facilities are exclusively state contracted? The patients, clients, are 100% state contracts?
I can't give you that information today. It might be available, and if it is, I'd be happy to provide it
to you. Is it your perception that that's a fair, that that would be a small number, that almost all of the facilities have some percentage of private contracts? I mean, private.
No, it would not be my perception that all do have some percentage. It depends on what you're talking about. In the alcohol and drug, some of them might have some insurance. But for the most part, the publicly funded alcohol and drug programs, which is what you'd be talking about here, take referrals from the various DHR agencies for treatment.
If you had this bill, only would extend the immunities, the limits of tort claims for those patients who are there under a contract.
Mm-hmm.
Are you concerned that there still is liability for all those private insurance placements? There's still liability, and there's still going to be a need for private liability insurance. And as to those patients, the premiums probably not going to be a whole bunch different than it would be for everybody
there. I'd be happy to provide you with the data that we might have on that.
We need to pursue that because we might be giving you half a loaf that's inedible.
Further questions?
We're talking about food now, but we just ate it.
Is that a new analogy? Half a loaf is inedible?
I try to keep the discussions lively here in the Senate.
That's right.
After lunch, sometimes food analogies help.
That's right. Brings home the point.
Bring home the bacon.
Bring home the bacon or the bread. Any further questions from Ms. Millers? Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Any further witnesses on House Bill 3199?
We might ask the Department of Justice about if the council might ask them about their reporting requirements, because under the Tort Claims Act, part of it is immunities and limits, but it also imposes duties on agencies to notify the Department of Justice when a potential claim may have been filed, because they need to know that kind of thing for monitoring. I'm assuming the Department of Justice or the district attorney or somebody would have to be involved on a local level, and they might have a comment on their workload and fiscal impact to the department.
Okay. Staff? Thank you. No further witnesses on House Bill 3199. We're going to close the public hearing, and we're going to we're going to have a work session. We're going to round it here at 3. We have some proposed amendments that are going to be drafted up. We're going to hold this bill over for further work session. The amendments, at least one set that I'm aware of, will actually expand the coverage here. So, but in any case, this issue, as you can sense, has a varying point of reception among the committee members, but maybe should possibly have the constitutional requirement to get a committee in some form or another. So we'll wait for later, though, on that one. That'll be a subsequent work hearing down the road. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3199.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Before you bang the gavel. I'm going to look at that Willamette Larvie article, and unless I'm convinced that the limit itself, the kind of cap that I was talking about with Mr. Williamson, is unconstitutional, then I'm probably not only going to support the bill, but probably try and maybe broaden it actually a little bit to include some other social service charities. But I have to be convinced in my own mind first that the approach is constitutional.
Good, and we wish you luck in that endeavor. We're going to go ahead and go back to a work session on House Bill 2382, which we had a testimony up front on.
Chairman.
Representative Mannix.
I move House Bill 2382 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Mannix moves House Bill 2382 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. We'll ask Representative Clark and Emerson to give us a brief statement of what the bill means. Having heard enough, we'll move right along into
that's the bill that establishes the Uniform Transboundary Pollution Reciprocal Access Act.
No, that's usually involving other states or locations.
Okay. All right.
Often involving pollution.
Please explain to Representative Bell the nuances of long-arm jurisdiction and how it might apply in this case.
As opposed to strong-arm jurisdiction.
That's right. Strong-arm jurisdiction.
Representative Bell knows all about that because she was
there. I listened to the hearing, yeah.
That's right. Well, I just want to make sure.
I just wonder how they could get a name like that.
To make it as difficult as possible. That's why I'd like to have attorneys on this committee, so they can act like they know something when they really don't.
And some law school professor someday is going to refer to that in passing as UTPRA and expect people to know what that is.
UTPRA.
Is everyone else in the audience waiting for the Family Law Justice Committee to start at 3 o'clock?
No, I bet you someone's here for 2181.
International Commercial Arbitration.
2381.
That's just about as bad, isn't it?
That's the other bill that's on the agenda for the day, Mr. Chair.
I'm just checking, see if that they're here for.
It's one that we've got.
Anyway, let's get the bill done. We've got in front of us.
2382.
Any objection to this?
Don't we take a vote? I would vote on this, I think.
Do you think we should?
I would object.
Are you sure?
We don't vote.
Okay. Mr. Representative Emerson requests a roll call vote.
3199.
Well, somebody has to run the
dance. 2382.
2382. House
no amendments.
2382.
Good bill. Nice and clean.
Representative Clark.
Okay. Aye.
Representative Edmondson.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Mannix.
Aye.
Representative Bell.
Yes.
Chair Baum.
Votes yes. House Bill 2382, having received the constitutional majority, is forwarded to the full committee to do pass recommendation. Representative Mannix, carry that bill.
Thank you.
We're going to have open up a public hearing on House Bill 2381. We'd like to invite up Jerome Barton. We only got three witnesses I see here. Ross Runkle, Roger Martin, Why don't you all come up and have a seat right in front of us, and we'll...
I'm going to try to pronounce this. Representative Clark and I think that this is the Oi Kaka.
Oi Kaka.
That was written in
Oi Kaka.
I'm not a party to that.
Uh-oh.
I think that's a foreign language, Mr. Chair.
State tort claims liability.
I don't know if Andy's witness to speak it.
State tort claims liability.
You would think it's Friday afternoon, but it's not.
We worked through the weekend.
Mr. Barton, why don't you go ahead and... I don't know how long the chair of the Civil Subcommittee on Family Law will let us proceed here, but at least until 3 o'clock.
I think we're okay on that then. Oregon's arbitration laws, which were adopted primarily in 1989, do not reach international transactions in that they don't deal with foreign law, they don't deal with foreign languages, they don't deal with nationality of arbitrators. So consequently, our existing laws are inadequate to deal with international commercial business disputes. The purpose of this particular bill is to address only international commercial disputes. It has nothing to do with our domestic disputes. In no way does it affect the programs which are currently in existence, and they're functioning quite well through the circuit courts, and we have some pilot projects going on in the various circuits. One of the reasons why this particular bill has been supported by the International Law Section is that through the United Nations activities over a period of time and in consulting with many countries, they've tried to codify rules and practices which are acceptable and are comfortable with countries which have civil law, countries which have the common law, and countries which have laws that we don't even understand or have names for. And we believe the United Nations proposal is one that seems to be comfortable around the world and is being used more frequently. This particular bill is to harmonize Oregon's arbitration and conciliation laws to the United Nations Model Act. And there on page 2 of my deal, I've listed 10 of the reasons why we think it will do that and the benefits that will be provided for the people. The Oregon Act that we've proposed is primarily tailored after California's and British Columbia's, which is a little bit different than the Uniform Act of the United Nations. We have provided two specific new provisions which have to do with choice of arbitrators if there are United Nations provide if there's one or three arbitrators, then they have rules and regulations how to deal with it. We have adopted to go with the United Nations on that. And also, we have a problem with what happens if the location of the arbitration process is not agreed upon and the arbitral tribunal has not been formed or agreed upon or activated. And we have elected to put that task on the Chief Justice's shoulders rather than have the various circuit courts, whoever runs first to a circuit court, to have that decision chosen. The cost to the state in administering this law will be nominal in that the few occasions that there will be an expense is when we activate primarily the court's roles in enforcement or in resolving a few disputes which are left to the courts to decide. There is a one-time duty put on the Chief Justice's office, and that's to make rules and regulations dealing with non-attorneys or non-attorneys, the people who are not admitted to practice law in the state of Oregon, to participate in the arbitration and conciliation process. This becomes important primarily because internationally...
Can I cut in here for a minute? It will help me put things in context. If Representative Edmondson and I are here just scratching our heads a little bit, not knowing very much about international law, like next to nothing, why would I think that federal law would cover this, or that there would be a federal statute that would cover this kind of thing, A, and B, what happens now?
Well, there is a federal arbitration law, which is a little different than the United Nations arbitration law. There are a number of commercial arbitration associations, like the American Arbitration Association in existence, there's Copenhagen, and there's all kinds of conventions around the world. What we are choosing is the one selected by the United Nations as being more of a composite to adopt and say this will be the arbitration process for international business transactions in the state of Oregon, only if the parties agree that this is what they want. This bill imposes no unilateral obligation on anybody.
So it sets up a model into which parties can opt.
Yeah, it is a process. How do you select arbitrators? How do you select the law? How do you select?
So you and I would have a provision in our contract that says
we would elect to do this.
Well, all right.
Or we would elect not to. If we had an agreement that said we're going to use the American Arbitration Association rules and regulations and arbitrate through that process, this law would never come into effect. But
this just gives us another alternative.
Yeah.
Into which we can opt.
Right. This imposes nothing on anybody. It sets up a mechanical process that if people choose or elect to come under it, they may do so. It does not apply to domestic transactions. They have to go into our regular arbitration process, which we currently have through the court system, which either be affixed or attached or it could be part of the system. So it's just to kind of bring us into the international world a little bit more.